we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we're going to be talking about The Prisoner, episode A Change of Mind. Number 6 is working out in his self-made gymnasium when he is assaulted by two thugs intent on provoking a fight. They take exception to his standoffish, antisocial attitude, and when, after they start to beat him, he thrashes them, they shout, "You'll face the committee for this!" He does face the committee, who warn him that unmutual behavior will not be tolerated. They break for tea and will consider his case, pending a medical examination. When number 6 leaves, everybody avoids him. Number 2 is waiting for him in his quarters, and he explains he has nothing to do with the committee. If number 6 is found to be unmutual, there is nothing he can do to stop it. He introduces him to number 86, who will help him avoid being declared unmutual. She takes him to a social meeting, but he acts intentionally unsocial, and they run him out, just in time for his medical evaluation at the hospital. He's given a checkup and nothing more, but as he leaves, he meets a strangely behaving man who is also once declared unmutual. That man has a curious scar on his forehead. The committee readjourns and declares number 6 unmutual. Any further transgressions, and he will be subjected to instant social conversion. Now, absolutely everyone in the village completely avoids him, and the loudspeakers declare that no one should associate with unmutuals and report any further unmutual activity immediately to the subcommittee. The subcommittee are a group of right-minded women who want to help number 6, but he refuses their kind offer. Number 2, all the while watching, wonders just how much the loner can take with real loneliness. After some consternation at being constantly shunned, the subcommittee orders number 6 to be taken for instant social conversion. The villagers attack him and drag him to the hospital, where number 86 performs a lobotomy on him using a high-tech sonic device. Afterwards, he is calm and placid. In his quarters, number 2 suggests that they have a chat later on. In the meantime, number 6 is looking after him, fixing him tea. Although he is under the influence of the procedure, he notices number 86 putting a pill in his tea. He distracts her, and he pours the tea out, pretending to drink it. He goes to sleep, and she leaves. Number 2 arrives and starts to ask why he resigned. Number 6 becomes agitated, and number 2 backs off and leaves, for now. Number 2 and number 86 then observe him and see that he is beginning to shake off the effects of the procedure, which they reveal was faked with drugs, and the illusion is maintained by the drug they put in his tea. Number 2 orders number 86 to give him another dose, despite her protestations. Again, she attempts to administer tea, but he pours it out and teaches her how to make a proper cup of tea. In doing so, when she attempts to drug him again, he is able to switch drinks with her. Number 86 is soon very tranquilized. Number 2 observes her almost drunken behavior and recalls her. She leaves, and number 6, now very certain he's being manipulated with drugs, goes for a walk. At his gym, the thugs decide to even the score. At first, he doesn't resist, but soon he thrashes them again. He feels himself once more. He finds number 86 dallying instead of heading to number 2. He hypnotizes her into revealing how the hoax was done, and then plants an instruction into her mind for later. Number 6 goes to number 2 and he tells him, "I want to tell you why I resigned," but he arranges for it to be done in front of everyone. There, while he delays a bit, number 86 comes forward, declaring number 2 unmutual. The crowd turn on him and drive him away. Number 6 is still a prisoner. So how'd this episode work for you?
It worked rather slowly on me, I felt. It didn't grip. The story, I felt, didn't have enough to it, really, to fill the time.
I think that's fair. There's not much to this story. And I feel like it's somewhere between something like Free for All, which is meant to be heavily allegorical, or I think is meant to be heavily allegorical, and one of the more direct, realistic, if you will, episodes where they're just trying some scheme to get him. And I don't know that it works. It's not one of my favorites by any stretch of the imagination.
It felt to me like there wasn't much depth to the story they were trying to tell. The thing it most reminded me of was the kind of schoolyard politics, because you've got these playground thugs who come up and threaten number six, and when things don't go their way, they go telling, and it's like the committee are teacher and number six will be put on report for not doing what he was supposed to do, or not behaving by the rules. And obviously, you know, the fact that he was not the aggressor in this case is dismissed, because it's enough that there was a complaint, and you kind of have that sense of, well, any kind of trouble and you get tarred with being a troublemaker, you know, as you might do in school. And then in that sense, number two is almost like the headmaster. Number six has to go and see him, but you know, number two says, well, the committee is nothing to do with me, in much the same way as a headmaster kind of says, well, you know, playing the nice cop, as it were, well, you know, rules are rules and everyone has to obey them. And if you break the rules, well, there's you know, I may wish to, but there's nothing I can do about it. And you know, it didn't feel like it went much further than that, I suppose.
Go ahead.
Well, I wasn't really sure what it was getting at.
I wasn't sure what it was in aid of, that number two was so seemingly dedicated to convincing number six that he didn't have anything to do with this committee. I didn't get where that was going. I don't think number six would have behaved any differently. I don't think anybody is fooled. I mean, the audience, I don't think, is fooled. I mean, you didn't think that those two thugs were just doing that for fun, right? They were there on orders to stir up trouble, weren't they?
I wasn't sure about that, because I think they may have made a mistake, because when they came back to number six's homemade gymnasium, and number six still seemed to be at least partially under the impression that he had actually been lobotomized, it was their action, their repeat attack, that made him realise he still had all of his faculties and all of his capabilities as a playground scrapper.
I agree that's a mistake.
Well, it made me feel that that time, at least, they must have been doing that on their own. You know, they were there because they just wanted to be. So that made me wonder if, well, maybe that first, because I agree with you, the first time round, I did think they've been sent, this is a setup.
They're too specific, again, you know. Oh, it's, you're antisocial. You're, you know, why don't you hang out with the rest of us? You're that. And then as soon as they get, you know, evidence against him because he beats them up, then they go and lay into motion this plot, which is obviously the whole episode. So,
yes. I mean, I think there are other aspects, certainly number two's conversation with number 86, that suggests that, yes, it is a whole plot, or at least they're taking advantage of the fact that he has been brought before the committee, just to leave open the possibility that, you know, maybe that initial confrontation was purely something that just arose. And my explanation, if that were the case, if that were purely an incidental occurrence, for their saying, oh, you know, your antisocial behaviour, is the whole emphasis of this is on limiting his autonomy. And I'm coming back again to autonomy after the kind of themes from Living in Harmony, to limit his autonomy by threatening to isolate him from the rest of the community, because the committee insists on everyone behaving in what they would call this mutual way, and anyone who doesn't is declared unmutual and ostracized, and therefore the kind of functional society is therefore going to be made up of people who have at least accepted the need to be mutual or whatever, and taken on board this language and the way in which people who are brought before the committee are forced to kind of repeat those statements and internalize that language. You know, there's an element of conditioning, at least, if not brainwashing, in that.
Well, so just talking about the village and the committee and number two. So we have seen in episodes in the past where basically number two has enough power that if he says, everybody stop, everybody stops. So he can make anybody do anything he wants, with the exception of number six, obviously. But it hasn't always been that's how number two exerts his power. And what I kind of wonder, Living in Harmony is an example. He wants something done about the prisoner trying to escape the town, and so he tells the kid that he's seen Kathy with him. And that sets the kid in motion, but it's not telling him to go do something. Of course, it fails because he does it wrong. So I kind of, when the episode starts, I think the two thugs have been sent there specifically by the management of the village to start this antisocial kick. Then when they come back and make their mistake later in the episode, and there's just no way around it, that the plot hinges on this stupid mistake on their part, blowing. Maybe there'd be other ways to do it, but for time purposes, they just knock him a right angle and solve the problem by the fact that they've done something that number two couldn't possibly have told them to go do at this point. What I'm wondering is if it's one of those things like a little word in your ear kind of thing. Number six is a bit, you know, a little antisocial.
Yeah, so and then they're being set up rather than sent as soldiers.
Right. And so later they want revenge because he beat them up. And they think he's, so they are truly just bullies who spy an opportunity. So, you know, they were, but still it's number two. It's not the committee that did that. Number two is manipulating the committee too. There probably is a committee for unmutual people, but he's playing chess with them and setting it up so that number six bounces into these positions.
Agreed.
So, but it's an unnecessary layer in the episode. Because it doesn't fool number six for a second. I mean, literally doesn't fool him for one single second. So, I don't know why they do that. I wanted to ask whether you thought that he was really being bothered by being lonely.
I didn't. And that I felt was part of the problem. I don't know whether it was a problem with the episode. It was certainly a problem with number two's plan. Because the whole point was to ostracize number six in order to force him to conform. And, you know, clearly going back to that sort of schoolroom context or whatever, you know, if you're a kid at school, what you want is you want to fit in and you want to have friends. And you don't want to be the center of attention and to be the one who stands out for being different, for not doing the things other people do, feeling the way other people feel. But number six is a strong individual adult, and to what extent does he have a need really to
associate or fit in? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. To associate. You know, there's the kind of daily thing of the kind of normal interactions, the being a part of.
His chess game, yeah.
There's the emotional things, the kind of having friendships or whatever. And we know number six to be someone who will do whatever he needs to do to function on a daily basis. But I can perfectly easily imagine him, you know, if he made an escape attempt and managed to get away and found himself miles from anywhere, so having to survive on his own in the wilderness. I can imagine him managing that perfectly well without kind of going mad.
Yeah.
And equally, from an emotional perspective, we know this is a guy who can shut himself down, who is willing to trust no one. So the kind of emotional fulfillment he must normally get through life in the village must be close to zero, because no one there will be allowed in. He won't let friendships form anyway. So what's he losing?
Yeah, and further, you know, there are three situations, as you're right. If he thrust into some sort of wilderness survival, I have no problem believing that this man could function on his own for a huge amount of time. But we also know that he can, as you say, he can shut himself down to all the people in the village. If they all left him like when in Many Happy Returns, the village was empty. He didn't seem to be suffering from any emotional problems there from being alone. I mean, he was curious. No,
he didn't go, oh my God, where are all my friends? Or even, you know,
where am I gonna get water? Or,
yeah, you know, who am I gonna play chess against?
But he knows they're doing this to him. And for the stubborn, pig-headed man that he is, to me, that just means it would have no effect on him at all, because he would know. He knows. He knows this is a game they're playing. And in fact, I think you see a lot of that in his attitude all the way up to the lobotomy, is he knows whatever they do is not permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just tell from the smile on his face and the fact that, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go to this social meeting and I'm going to clap loudly and be a jerk and interrupt them all the time, because what are they going to do to me? They're not actually going to do anything to me. You do kind of see that in this performance up until the point when they strap him down to the table. And then you kind of see the fear in McGowan's face.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I'm not even sure it's because he knows it's temporary, because I can perfectly well imagine him behaving like that down at his local pub if he found the people unsympathetic or contemptible. So, you know, I just... That seems to be his character, which is that he doesn't care.
Yeah. And he doesn't, yeah, he doesn't need to. So, so again, that fails for me. It resolves too quickly. He figures it out. They're just all sorts of little problems in this episode. I just don't think it's a particularly good episode of The Prisoner. It's not the worst, but it's not great. This was written by a guy named Roger Parks. This is his first freelance script commission that he ever had. He got the job through a friend. He was working at the BBC in some other capacity, and somebody introduced him to George Markstein as, you know, possible to write it. And he pitched an idea, and Markstein liked it, and he went with it. His brother was a psychiatrist, and so he had some ideas based on stuff he knew from about the Manchurian Candidate and about lobotomies that his brother had told him about, and so that, and drugs.
I did wonder. Certainly, when we got to the lobotomy scene, it made me think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh yeah,
I wondered if that had been an influence at all, particularly when you think about the kind of themes within this about the idea of conformity and control, and the kind of control mechanisms that are exerted over the inmates in that.
Lobotomies were big at that time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I'd be surprised if he hadn't read it. But
yeah, and it does mention that. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's. There's influences from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest there. And, you know, that is probably the key piece of literature that anyone might have come in contact with that deals with lobotomies. So, it came there at kind of the end of the lobotomy craze, if you will. So, you know, I don't know whether this is, I'm not sure whether this is before or after. I think it's after One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but I'm 100% sure that it's after. But I think it was a topic that was on my...
Yeah, I think that was early 60s.
Speaking of the Times, just to break my train of thought for a second, speaking of the Times, in the 1960s, you talk about the schoolboy wanting to fit in. It's my perception, rightly or wrongly, that society was a lot more conformist in the 50s and prior, that standing out wasn't necessarily the good thing. Not necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, we live in a time where you can walk down the street in a Doctor Who scarf if you actually wanted to. And you might get some sneakers, or fez, and you would not be treated in the way that you would have been if you'd tried that in the 50s or early 60s. And so I wonder if the idea here was that this was, that it wasn't so much a school ground mentality, but it was meant to be a society as a whole, the conformity of society.
Yes.
As a whole, the counterculture movement. Now we would look at it and say, yeah, it still fits more with school child, because, you know, kids at that age are still much more concerned about fitting in than they are when they are adults now. So I pass that on. Roger Parks, back to him. First script, he's also written for Blake 7, Doomwatch, The Survivors, several other shows, The Oneiden Line, But those were the genre shows that came to mind. Although, honestly, I've never seen that name before, and I've watched every episode of Blake 7, and I haven't double-checked it. I'm going by what the book says that he wrote for Blake 7, but honestly, I can't think of which episode he wrote, so I may have to look that up. They weren't all written by Terry Nation. Many of them were written by Terry Nation, but they weren't all written by... it was his first script. He went in, he made the pitch, Mark Stein liked it, they plowed him with alcohol, wrote scripts, and then, made some changes, and then they go to what they call the rehearsal reading with McGoohan, and that started with, for starts, we cut the kissing. And because there was...
because it was much like every other script. He could have had a recorded message, couldn't he?
Number 86 actually in the original script quite fancied number 6. And a lot of flirting with him. There's nothing in the script that actually would show kissing, so I don't know. Maybe there was another revision that McGoohan is referring to, or maybe Parks is misremembering it. That's a quote from him. And then the next thing that McGoohan did was he said, this script is only going to work if I direct it, and fired the director on the first day of rehearsals. So Joseph Cerf is Patrick McGoohan.
Okay.
And he added a lot of the clapping that he would do, and the guy who came out and is confessing, and the recorder's telling him what to say, and he's repeating it. That's a McGoohanism. The guy actually came out in the original script. The guy kind of comes out and he goes, "They're right, of course. I was wrong. Believe me, I was wrong." And he just kind of wanders out, kind of sadly, like maybe he's going to die or something. No big speech or anything like that, but that was all kind of added in.
Well, I quite like those changes, but I have to say one of the things that struck me as a weakness of this one, and it reminded me of Free For All again, was the fact that certain things were not necessarily very clearly signposted, and not in a kind of interesting, ambiguous way, but more in a kind of... We're going to reveal this rather slowly, even though it's not very interesting. And I'm thinking about, for example, the question of when he was apparently lobotomized, but of course we know he wasn't, and so we're questioning that fact, and we're seeing him being slipped the drugs and him slipping those away, and at that point. It's not absolutely clear what has happened to him, but obviously we've got the question in our mind, eventually it gets explained quite laboriously, but not straight away. So we're left wondering what's going on there. Meanwhile, he obviously knows enough about what's going on to pour away the drug tea. But we don't know does he realize he hasn't been lobotomized? And then when he's pouring away the drug tea and number two comes in, he then becomes rather excited. So what's going on there? Is he behaving excitedly because he has been affected mentally by believing that he has been lobotomized? Is he pretending to get excited because he wants to emulate the effect of having been drugged?
I thought the possibility there for him getting excited was so that he could try to make, if he's aware, then he's doing that because he thinks they will back off because they don't want him to get excited. But I don't know. Depends on whether he knows or not.
There are a load of variables in there. It could be a number of different things. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference, which it is, to be honest. But I suppose it makes this scene a bit less compelling if we don't really know what's going on. Because it reminds you of the fact it doesn't make a lot of difference. So it kind of robs the scene of its drama.
Okay, tell me how this alters your perception of the tea. So we'll talk about the tea, but we'll start with number 86. In the script, as I said, she fancied him, and she was flirting with him, and he was sort of flirting back with her. In the first scene...
She doesn't fancy him
Oh, I think she does, but it's toned back. But it's not. And why wouldn't he fancy her? What an attractive young lady she is. But even for a mad lobotomist, when she first comes in, she has a Swedish accent. And our first scene where he comes says, you know, she's going to help you with stuff. She's got a Swedish accent, and she makes a cup of tea for him, the continental way, as the script says, and he pours it out into the potted plant, not because of
the continental way being. Whenever I've been on the continent, they give you a cup of water and a tea bag in the saucer.
That's how they gave it to us in Britain when I was there too. So I'm not going to. A little bit of, I can't think of its name. It's got a foo in it. tea bags. But yeah.
Oh, Typhoo.
Typhoo, there we go. Yeah. Anyway, she makes it pouring over leaves or something, and he, when she's doing it, he looks at it in disgust. It's not anything to do with pills. He just takes it and dumps it when she doesn't see it. Because he doesn't want to drink it. He just doesn't like his tea that way. And then after number two is gone and she's kind of climbing up to him, he says, well, I don't like girls who put on fake accents. And that's the last thing that thing. Now, the next time she shows up, she's talking with him and it's a scene that's completely cut out and she's talking in a normal English dialect. And she says, so what do you think about? And he goes, what about the voice with your accent? She says, yeah. Is it better? And he goes, yes, but I don't like women in slacks. Or trousers, and she kind of fumbles off. And then you'll note that scene is still left. When he wakes up, she says, what do you think about the dress? And he says, oh, much better than trousers. That's a leftover from the lines that were cut from earlier in the story. And when she makes him the tea right after the lobotomy, he does not see the pills. He's just pouring it out because he doesn't like the tea that way.
Oh.
It's like...
Well, that again casts another complexion if that is the case, that he hasn't seen the pill going in there. That casts another complexion on that scene with number two, because does he believe he's been lobotomized? Does he?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
and then and he does later do the same thing when he's now gotten suspicious. He does somehow. I think number two's visit makes him suspicious, and then when she comes back to give him more tea, he takes the tea, dumps it out in the potted plant, not in the sink, but in the potted plant, and says, no, I don't like women who can't make a decent cup of tea. And he goes off and he makes the tea, and he does spy her doing the pill and swaps it on her and gets her tranquilized. So it's a lot more luck than in the story as we see it. And it's also, there's this kind of progressive, where he's sort of stripping away her facade or something, or the personality that she's presenting, and he's changing her throughout the episode. So she's willing to be malleable for him, I guess, is the right way to look at it, because she likes him. So,
despite his casual sexism.
Yeah, calling her girl all the time, and yeah.
Fundamentally, the problem in it for me is it's not clear, at least while you're watching it, whether he is actually under some influence, whether that be, from the effect of believing he's been lobotomized or whatever, or whether he is actually acting that, in much the same way as during Free for All. It was never clear whether we were seeing him behaving in a certain way because he had been brainwashed or because he was pretending to be brainwashed. And unless you're given a real kind of reason to care about which it is and why, then it just feels like a bit of a turnoff to me, that.
Yeah, it's confused. And, you know, the writer said... He was a bit, frankly, crushed with his first script. It doesn't sound like it was changed that much, but just to have the star of the show just immediately start, you know, the stuff with the kissing's got to go. Well, he felt that the entire plot was contingent upon this sort of, I don't want to say relationship between the two of them, but that dynamic was mm-hmm. important to the way the story played out. And so, you know, that's gone. And he says, oh, I should have known, because my wife worked at the Catholic school that McGowan's daughter went to, or something like that. And so he was semi-aware of that. But, and then the way Parks characterizes it, you know, in other accounts, you see that it says McGowan fired the director on the first day, I believe, of rehearsals. Did not get along with it and took over. We've seen that before. But Parks characterizes it as McGowan saying, this script won't work unless I direct it. So now we carry that forward and say some of the changes that McGowan made are the way that they interact in the committee, the way that he is much more... surreal is not the right word again, but there's a sense of detachment there from reality that the original script was really more straightforward. When he goes to the committee, he goes into a room with, you know, eight men, and they talk to him, as opposed to McGowan's version, where he goes into a room with two or three men and some tape recorders talking to him, and things like that, that McGowan has done to the story. And is that his idea of salvaging it? Is that, you know, with his free-for-all, which we commented was very disjointed and kind of not had a good grasp of plot or reality. It's like, I see similarities with free-for-all in this, in those kinds of scenes where seems like he's trying to say something with the way that it's all laid out that isn't in the words on the script. And I'm wondering if that's his thought. It's how he's saving the day with this script. Park said he gets money for it still in residuals, so...
Not too unhappy then.
Yeah, I guess it went many years before they ever got a lawyer to straighten it out with ITC before anybody got any royalties, but now he gets a couple £100 a year, so he's okay with it. I don't say I blame him.
Well, I guess McGowan was inserting things that he thought were interesting ideas, but I didn't. I mean, both of those changes that you allude to seem to me probably to make the thing stronger, but I did feel that in Free For All, a lot of the things lacked any kind of sense of cohesion to fit into the narrative overall, and it's probably only by virtue of the fact that it sounds like he changed less of this script that it's still a cohesive narrative, albeit a rather slow and padded one.
There's a couple of other things that got cut out of the script, and there's one that's pretty obvious that they filmed and then, or were planning on filming and cut out of the script at a late date. There are two places after he has been declared unmutual where the villagers basically gang up on him and try to kill him. And in one, he escapes, and I forget where the two places are, but like the first day when he leaves after being declared unmutual, I think they attack him, and it's right after the geese. So he's staring wistfully. That one gets me. He's staring wistfully at those geese, like, gosh, I wish I had a flock to fly with. Sigh. And and then he's attacked by the villagers, and he escapes from their murderous clutches, and he goes home. Then after he goes to the coffee shop and he leaves, he's attacked again. And he escapes and gets into his quarters, and inside is the subcommittee. And they're saying, okay, well, you know, we warned you. And if you look at that scene, his hair is all messed up when he walks in that door. It looks like he's been tussled about. And her first words is, you can't go
on. Perhaps just using inferior hair product or something at that point.
I thought it was just, when I watched the episode, I was thinking, it's like, wow, he's so upset about the geese and not being able to get a cup of coffee that he's like beginning to not bother to groom himself. Like, you know, kind of that like, oh, maybe next he'll have a beard and just not, it's kind of sulky. But to realize that when they say, you see that, you know, you need to come around, they're referring not to the fact that he's wandering around lonely. They're referring to the fact that they're going to kill him. They're going to beat him up and kill him. And then they open the door and let them drag him off, because that's why they're all outside. They chased him to his house. And again, it's like that one must have been late in the day, because McGowan's hair is obviously all tussled up. In fact, it's tussled up all the way through to the hospital scene when they've got him, put him on the bench. Of course, he gets more tussled up, but still. Anyway, I don't know. I'm more convinced by them attacking him than I am him staring wistfully at the geese.
Yes. It would seem to make more sense to have left it in, or maybe they didn't get around to filming it for some reason.
Could also be a combination. It's like, I can't even go back to my house and sleep in a comfy bed because they'll kill me. But I can't leave the village because it's the village. So maybe, you know, maybe they're trying to isolate him because he can't come into town. And when he tries, he gets attacked again. All that would make more sense to me for why it would bother him. Like, and yes, he could withstand it and survive. I know he could stand it and withstrive out there, and that he could buy with it. But at least it feels more of a threat or of a concern to him than just, oh, when I go into the coffee shop, I can't order a coffee because no one will talk to me. Because all he has to do there is just wait until they've put somebody else's cup of coffee down and walk up and sit down at their table. And they get up and he drinks their coffee and off he goes. It's like, that's, you know, I need some stuff at the store. I walk into the store. They have to leave. I take my stuff. I write down an IOU and I go. I would think he could go on forever like that. As long as there was food and water in the village, if they aren't going to talk to me, fine. I don't want to talk to them either. Anyway. All right. So one of the things that I'm just going to ask, did you notice that when he got up to speak in front of the village that there was Mayan artwork on the cloth that was hanging over the railing there?
No.
Just an odd bit of, well, it could be Aztec, could be Mayan, but it's some sort of South American native style. It's very out of place. And
oh, I didn't spot it.
McGowan touch. It's not in the script. It's just a set of set dressing. Now, of course, none of this was really shot in Port Merion this time. It was all stand-ins, I believe, for any of the Port Merion shots. And so it wouldn't true.
I was particularly struck by the sequence at the start in his gymnasium in the woods, which was clearly in a studio, but intershot with, I think they had a couple of shots of branches against the sky, and then later on a shot of him looking down at the sea, which quite clearly didn't fit with the studio set. But
well, that was the same workout he did in the, was it the episode with...
the art competition, was it?
I was thinking there was also, yeah, it could be in the art competition, but there was also the sequence where maybe it was Peter Wingard's number 6 was getting a prognostication on what his day would be. And one of them was workout, and they were showing it on the workout. It was a lot, felt like a lot of stock footage of his workout.
Well, that episode must have been filmed in Port Merion. Sure.
Yeah, certainly parts of it were. Anyway, not shot in Port Merion, so I don't think it was trying to hide something. I remember seeing a behind-the-scenes documentary on the Doctor Who episode Mask of Mandragora, which was also shot in Port Merion. And
oh, was it?
Yeah, it's entirely shot in Port Merion.
I shall need to rewatch.
There is a scene where the Doctor is taken through somewhere, probably that village square, and they have put... it's the Count is riding his horse through the town. They've had to put tapestries over the railings because they're anachronistic for a medieval Mediterranean village. And that was the first thing that crossed my mind when I saw that. It's like, oh, that's just like in Doctor Who, where they had to hide the stuff that just would not fit with the village. But it's like, but this is a studio. So it's obviously on purpose for some reason. Anyway. I thought it was kind of weird.
So thinking about that scene, there are a couple of things that I wondered about that. One was how credible did it seem that number two would allow number six to explain his resignation in front of the whole village? Not just because there might have been at least surely some small suspicion in his mind that number six might actually be playing him, but also because why would he want everyone to hear about that? This is the vital information they've been after for ages, but not, one presumes, to broadcast it.
There's a school of thought that says that the intent, they're not as concerned about finding out why he resigned as they are convincing him to tell them. Is that if they can convince him to tell him, then he's theirs. And so it's not as much why. It's a power thing. We control you. You do what we tell you to do. At the same time, we have seen, gosh, now I wonder if this is a cut scene from one of the earlier episodes, Dance of the Dead. Wasn't there a line? There definitely was a line. It was either a cut line or not line, where no one is safe unless everyone knows everyone else's secrets. That was a mantra of one of the people in the prison villains. So given that context, if that's the way they feel, then maybe they wouldn't care.
Yes, although you kind of think that probably applies somewhat selectively. Does that include probably number two and, you know, people working directly for number one? I would imagine not.
The whole ending doesn't work for me. He's so unconvincing when he's talking to number two, going, "Oh, but I could tell everybody, and maybe that would convince some of them to give you." Oh, what a good idea! It's like, he is so playing you. It's like, it's so obvious he's playing you, and he's not even hiding the fact that he's playing you. And you're just hook, line, and sinker going. So I'm not convinced by that. I'm also not convinced that number 86 can shout at number two and say he's unmutual, and the whole village would go, "Yeah, okay, tear him apart." I don't get that, unless that's supposed to go back to the line, which makes no sense, where number 86 says she's higher than number two. I mean, she's obviously higher than number two because she's tanked up on the drugs, which I think is why number six kind of has a little witty, "Oh, really?" kind of thing.
I mean, I think that if she meant she were higher in rank, I think that would be almost a triple meaning, because there's the double meaning in terms of she's a higher number than number two.
That's right.
As well as clearly being high. So I didn't take that literally. I kind of felt that scene was supposed to be riffing on Mark Antony's speech in Julius Caesar.
You mean
Caesar, not to praise him.
The end, not the part where she's saying she's higher.
No. But the part where she comes in and declares that number two is unmutual,
oh, yeah,
is, you know, that's almost incidental. The point I felt, although I agree it didn't necessarily get the build up and the performance it needed, but the point was for number six to really warm up the audience by doing that whole "for Brutus is an honourable man" bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is, you're right. You're absolutely right. The writer has, that's confirmed. That was where he drew that from, that last part. So, because
mm-hmm.
it's fiction. It's a fantasy show. We can draw on things like that. Not a show. Absolutely
fair enough.
I think you can even draw it on reality shows if you, not reality shows, but you know what I mean. Shows that are meant to be more realistic. Like, why not? I mean,
but it's not stealing from the greats that's a problem at all. It's more that that performance didn't quite sell it. You know, he wasn't a particularly great Mark Antony. So
to borrow one of number two's sayings, "The butcher with the sharpest knife has the warmest heart." I like the look on the face of the audience on that one. It's like, what is he saying? Because it doesn't make any sense at all. But it sounds like he's saying something nasty, but I don't know what it is. The script basically refers to number two being a sort of big peasantish country folk. And so a lot of his things about plowing and strong as a bull. There's several references throughout this thing that are sort of farming country, those sort of folksy sayings that were intended to go with the casting of the part of number two. And then they turned around and cast a sort of almost effeminate, I wouldn't say frail, but, you know,
but a rather well manicured, city gent type.
Yeah. Which, you know, may also have been McGoohan. Like, hey, you know, that would be, you know, putting two things at odds, but he kept them. But you kind of lose it. But
it's interesting that the scripts are actually actively trying to characterize particular number twos, because, I mean, obviously, partly their behavior in each episode is going to inform the characterization that they choose, but equally who they cast. And, you know, this is a big guest cast role in each episode, or mm-hmm. in most of the episodes that we've seen. And it seems to me that who they cast must have a huge effect on how the character is portrayed. Well, of course, it's not the same character, but how that part is played in each episode. So in a way, I guess I'd imagine that in some sense, the script writers were keeping number two quite colourless and allowing the actor who was then cast to come in and shape that as they chose. From what you say, it sounds like, in fact, the writer was giving some direction as to what kind of number two they were expecting to get.
Yeah, and do remember this is his first script. His first professionally commissioned script. So, and he's working with the script editor, and so they're helping him.
Yeah, he must have had some direction on that.
That's not, in any show, that's not wrong. I mean, when you're writing a script, the conventional wisdom that I have read about, from, you know, like professional script writers, is you only put things in the script like that, whether it's how the camera is supposed to go, or what the character is supposed to look like, or how they're supposed to sound, if and only if it is important to the script itself, and that you let the director handle everything else.
Sure.
And but this script does contain things like whip pan onto the prisoner when...
Ah.
And those are gone. Those are gone. But it's not wrong to say, you know, number two, you know, walks into the room. He is a tall man wearing a cowboy hat and wearing six shooters with an American drawl. If that informs the character, informs the way the character acts throughout the story.
But that's what surprises me, that they would do that with number two, given that...
But don't you think, like, the episode where he's always drinking milk and nervous all the time, I think it's in there that says, you know, number two is a sort of small, nervous type.
But that comes from the script. Because in a sense, you could imagine an actor and a director getting together and looking at the journey that particular number two is going to take in that particular script, and developing those kinds of mannerisms and the behavior.
But that's
in that performance.
That's a good example, though, because in that episode, we have several touch points where number two is contacted by number one. So, I mean, that's dialogue that comes in the script and his reaction to that. So making him a squirrely,
absolutely,
nervous
of course
man
that must come from the script.
Making him a squirrely man to begin with, or a nervous type, actually, I think probably does legitimately belong in the script as a signpost for them to cast and fill in. But a lot of times there probably isn't anything in the script, because however you want to play it, like, I think Leo McKern is probably a good example. I don't think in that script there's really anything about his character, and so then they bring him in and they let him make it his own. I think it just depends on whether the writer feels that it's important, this story. Now, in this case, I think what they're going for is to play that line at the end with about the butcher with the sharpest knife has the warmest heart, because number two does make a number of sort of sayings along the way. I think he calls them proverbs, but in the scripts they're not called proverbs. So that's a change that probably the actor, there's a proverb that says a man who plows straight doesn't have to worry about anything. And there's also a couple of them that have been cut out as part of it. So it was an ongoing thing that in the dialogue of the character, and I think the writer was trying to say, to justify that in the characterization of this being sort of a country guy. I don't know if he's going to have a Somerset accent, but he's it's like just it obviously they didn't go with it, and yet at the same time they didn't remove some of the sayings. So ultimately the writer can be overdrawn, but I don't think it's wrong for them to include some direction as to how they see the character.
I'm just surprised at it in the case of number two, because it seems to me in the behavior, in the fact that he has these phone calls with number one, say going back to A, B, and C, you can infer the nervousness. The writer doesn't need to put that in the script because it's there in the dialogue. Similarly, you know, if you have a number two who is fond of using proverbs or whatever, then that itself is going to come across in the dialogue. And
yeah, how about something as simple as this? You write your character and they're adversarial to number six. So here's a classic example of in life, for that matter, or storytelling. It's like it would make a difference. I don't know how tall Patrick McGoohan is, but let's say he's 6 foot tall. He's the star of the show. Being adversarial against a number two who's 5 foot tall versus being adversarial against a number two who's 5 foot six or 6 foot six could have something in the way that the two characters play against each other. A big guy will have a different attitude, perhaps, towards how he interacts with a smaller man as opposed to vice versa. And so, for example, you could take from a small man might go for a more cerebral approach than a physical one in a situation like that. So again, you know, just the line, number two is a small, frail man, or an elderly man, or those could really be important to the way that the writer wants the people reading his script to understand what he has in mind. That could be completely screwed up from his vision of the script. And I mean, at the point where you finish the script, it is your vision. Yes, the director can change it around. They can rewrite it. They can do whatever they want to it. But I think, you know, not like, you know, you will cast so and so, or this man must have this, or, but here's one. He's got to have a scar down his cheek if it's important. Yeah, I got this in a dueling thing in Germany in World War I. And he has to be able to convey some of the important physical characteristics that go with the motivations of his character along the way. And then it's up to the actors and the director to fill in where that isn't there, or to ignore it, but at their own peril to the writer.
I'm not sure I buy it, because I think that most of those things are not going to be very central to the plot. I mean, in some cases, sure they are, but...
Yeah, I don't see that it's terribly central to this plot.
We're talking about, they don't form major plot points, and what you get in this case is this odd line in the kind of climactic speech in the episode that no longer really relates back to anything, so the thing feels like
a mess. I do agree that it's not... For what they put in it, it's not very important in this particular case. But I don't, and I'm writing off to the inexperience of the writer here, saying that perhaps he was trying to do something that he didn't need to do with the character, because it doesn't really pay off. But I don't fault him I don't fault a writer for doing that if there's a valid reason for it. And of course, the writer, he thinks he has a valid reason for it. That is ultimately for the production team to decide whether or not that was, and the script editor to come along and say, let's steer away from that. And then Patrick McGoohan could go, no. It's
like, yeah, well, of course. And yeah, I mean, there's a point where you have to let go. The thing that just, it made me wonder about was that it felt like an odd thing to be doing with number two. And for all I know, all the writers on the show have been quite prescriptive about the particular number two that they're going to have. But Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It that could be the case, or it could be that really this is the writer in this case fundamentally misunderstanding the kind of role that number two and this kind of revolving guest starring role actually plays within the show.
I'm not sure where this one fell, but this one's still back when Mark Steyn was working on the show before he had his big falling out with McGoohan. So it's one of an earlier script, if not.
It certainly seemed like an earlier script, if only because we're back to this focus on the resignation, which,
yeah,
you know, some of the scripts are not quite as specific about that's what the goal is in terms of breaking number six or getting that information out of him.
I don't. You got anything else?
No, I don't think I have. You've covered everything.
Oh, the only other thing I'll say here is that, just a production note, McGoohan was working on the scene where they drag him to the hospital, and he's working on what is described as a complex tracking shot showing the upside-down point of view of number six. And while he was doing that, it hit to be 9 o'clock. And the lights went out, and everyone left. to McGoohan's fury. You hear about that on Doctor Who, but I didn't know it happened to the guys at ITC as well. Was it ITV? ITV. So I sounds like maybe he didn't inspire them to want to stay and work late.
Well, it sounds to me like even the most inspiring directors were still at the mercy of the kind of strength of the union rules on this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trade unionist in me is thinking, fair enough.
But then why don't we have an episode of The Prisoner that's about trade unions? Because this seems like the kind of thing that would have got McGoohan going, you know, I ought to write a script.
Yeah. I could imagine it. I could.
And I'm not going to spoilery give out that there isn't one. There isn't one. But, you know, one... second season. When they make that second season of The Prisoner, there'll be one about trade unions.
And the one thing that I did note in, if not McGoohan's favour, at least in number six's favour, was that he does appear to know how to make a good, if rather strong, cup of tea. Including putting the milk in first, which is, of course, quite the right way to do it. Send your letters to...
See, I thought it was just mostly, it's the hot water, the cup, the tea bag. That's how you do it. And then if you're...
Tea bag?
And in this,
did you say tea bag?
I did say tea bag. And then if you're, frankly, over here, if you're a bit of a poser, you get one of those little infuser balls and you say, ooh, it's so much better.
You can't compare tea made out of a bag with tea made with leaves.
Well, what's in the bag?
Sawdust, I would imagine, from the taste. It's certainly some kind of powder. If you open it up and look inside, it doesn't have, you know, big, proper, beefy leaves in it.
Does a whole leaf... So if you were making tea, okay, let's use your big, proper leaves. Okay. Let's test this theory. So you've got big proper leaves, and then how do you brew them? You put them in an infuser?
Well, most of my life,
throw them in the water
putting the leaves straight into warm the pot, like number six. Put the leaves into the pot, and then pour boiling. And this is what the Continentals don't understand, but it's because they drink coffee, of course. Pour boiling water onto the leaves, and stop them getting in your tea. When you pour it through a strainer. But I have now acquired a pot that has a kind of basket inside the pot. So you place the leaves into this basket that sits in the pot, pour the hot water on, and then, of course, the leaves stay in the basket. So when you pour the tea out, it pours without any leaves, and they don't go up the spout and block it. I can tell I'm becoming a bit of a tea bore. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
that's the proper way to do it, listeners.
Okay. So if I take your big proper leaves and I take a pair of scissors and I cut each leaf in two parts, would it taste the same before you brewed it? Obviously.
Why would you want to do that?
I'm just checking here because you know at what point, how many times do I have to cut this down to its close to little crumbly bits that it no longer tastes the same. That's what I don't understand. Oh, don't, I mean, I assume that what's in the tea bag is actually officially tea.
they sweep up the kind of leftovers, the powder you get at the bottom of the tin. That's what they stick in the tea bags. That's why it tastes so foul.
Well, if it's of any help, I have walked through actual tea fields in where they're picking, and I've seen them do the little process, and I've even gone in to a tea shop in a tea place, not a tea, but like in the farm, and had tea there.
Wonderful.
And I love tea, but I'm not as convinced that it was any different than what I would get in town. So but there you go. So next time we're going to be talking about tea again. And what is the next episode of The Prisoner?
I do believe it's Hammer into Anvil.
Anvil. Yes. Interesting title. All right. Well, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.